Hi, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning.
Doug, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
All right. We got 11:15 for our time. Should we start?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Okay, so we were discussing last week King Solomon left off, he finished off discussing the issues of justice and the fact that there's no perfect correlation between righteousness and a good life and wickedness and evil. Sometimes wickedness finds success and righteous people end up with negativity. So we went through the whole area. And as Ibn Ezra said, that chapter 9, verse 13 begins a new topic, and you see it does, because he starts talking about the positive nature of wisdom. So I just would, you know, going over the verses more, and there are just a few more observations I wanted to just make. And but just to recap, we talked about the fact that he first opens up by saying in 9:13, he says, "This also I have seen under the sun." And we said that that's because there was really no question about wisdom in terms of the ultimate state of the soul, which is not on earth. So there's no question there. The only discussion that needs to be addressed is the tachas shemesh, under the sun, meaning the earthly the condition, and how wisdom plays a role there. And even though he talks earlier, and he says, not to the wise is there food. Meaning, even though a person may be wise, but we said that was in verse 11. Nonetheless, he still says that wisdom is something which is great. But you see, he says it's great to me. We didn't underline that last word. He says, this also I've seen, that wisdom under the sun is a great thing to me. Why is he saying that? We didn't raise that question. We went into the next verse where he gives an example. After he makes a statement, he gives an example of how we see wisdom being so great. And that was a case where there's a great king and there's a small city that he besieges. And he surrounds it and he builds up a great fortitude, attack. And in the city, there's found, and we mentioned that he's just found, meaning he's not a popular person. And what is found there is a wise man, but he's poor. And he saves the whole city with his wisdom. But no man makes mention of him. And Ibn Ezra says that before he saved the city, he really was not taken notice of. Which makes sense, because if he does succeed and people know about it, so he'll become a hero. But beforehand, this person is not really favored because people are not following the life of wisdom. They're trying to follow the passions. So a person who's wise and talks about the soul, and that's where his message is, that's going to, you know, conflict with what people really want. Okay. And then King Solomon says that I say, this is now 16. He says, Vamartani, and I say, so it sounds like he's saying, despite that, I still say that better is wisdom than strength. And while wisdom of the fool of the wisdom of the miscreant, the poor man, is still despised, and his words are not listened to. So you see, he's pitting up two issues: the fact that the wisdom is greater than it's better than strength, and even, and he puts in the same verse, so to speak, it sounds like he's saying, even though that the poor person, the wisdom of the poor person is despised and his words are not heard. So we said that it's pitting up the social to truth, to what is real. So King Solomon is addressing the overarching emotion that people fall prey to, and that's whatever is popular, whatever is socially accepted, that is what they place so much value into. You see, that's the whole point of the king laying hold on the city too. War, if a king is wealthy and he's got everything he needs, what is he fighting? It's for social reasons. Even more fame, more power. But inherently, for the king, by definition, should be a very wealthy individual and have everything he needs. An intelligent king would prefer to have a peaceful existence. He has everything he needs and then some. So why is he going out to battle more? Why is he trying to attack a small city which just seems to be easy prey? Evidently, the king lives in the realm of the social too. And it makes sense that this king is going after this city, because why is he a king to begin with? He's a king because he cares about the social, about his position amongst others. The social status is very important. That's where Rabbi Chit says that anybody who's running to be a leader should not be a leader. By definition, they're out for themselves and they're not out to really assist people, which is what a true leader would be. And you see that Moses debated with God about taking on the role to take out the Jews for 7 days. Rabbi Chait explained also that other leaders too, all the great leaders, they only took on the position when they saw that they were indispensable in terms of the welfare of the Jews. That was their real concern. Okay. You see, Einstein also, he was offered to be the Prime Minister of Israel, and he turned it down. Who today would turn down that? People fight their way to get in line to be leaders. That's because of the social realm. That's a very powerful thing. I believe that's what he's talking about here. And perhaps that answers why he says that under the sun, I've seen wisdom as a great thing to me, meaning my view of it. It's not a great thing to the world, because in the social realm, it doesn't wash. So it could be that's why he's saying that at the end of verse 13. All right, so far so good. Any questions?
Not bad, yeah.
Good. But you're expecting one then?
Well, the question that's lurking in the back of my mind is that...
I knew there was something there.
I thought I remembered from a long ago series of tapes that Rabbi Chait did on Ecclesiastes, that he eventually gets around to the point of showing that kind of hidden in all this, King Solomon really is saying that wisdom is the ultimate thing. And so you indicated here, he's saying, well, it seems great to him. So are we going to get to a point where he ever acknowledges that it's a good, you know, sort of universally, or is that not where you think King Solomon's going?
Well, it could be. I don't think that this means that it's only his own feeling on it. He is trying to tell you that I, as the wise person, am valuing this, even though the rest of the world is not. But that's because it's people looking for things that, you know, make a mark socially. See, he's trying to tell you, I'm the wise one. I really know better. So, but I mean, he does say at the end, and we'll see if we do come up with any other verses, but he says that, you know, following the Torah and the mitzvos, this is all of man. And that's why he concludes the book. He says in the second to last verse, The end of the matter, after all is heard, you should fear God and you should guard his mitzvos, because this is the entirety of man. And that's actually, you know, they wanted to hide away the book of Kohelis. I think we mentioned it a few times. The rabbis, they didn't want it to be a public work, because it seems like he's going back and forth. But as we explained it, when it talks about that it's better to be a live dog than a dead lion, right? Things like that, people just value life over death because it sounds like it's a denial of the world to come and all. We've explained it very clearly that we understand that that's not him, that's not his values. He is vocalizing the opinions of people, and that's Ibn Ezra. But most people aren't going to study it that well to see that, and they're going to just think that the king is rejecting it. The greatest king of Israel is rejecting something like that. So that, you know, on the surface, it would be misleading. So the rabbis wanted to not disclose the book. They wanted it to store it away. But they said, since it ends on this note, they allowed it to, you know, to be published and circulated, because he closes on the right note. But there may be other verses to it, because we're just breaking into the area now where he's talking about the greatness of wisdom. But, you know, even the verses that are coming up, he doesn't say him, like me anymore. He says, for example, the heart of the wise is in the right, and the heart of the fool is in the left. The right always means like the right is like more preferred. So there he's talking objectively. So we'll see. I'm sure that there'll be more. There's more to say on this. Okay.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, for example, there was another verse, I'm sure we did it yet, where a fool walks in darkness, and then wisdom is like light of day. I'm not sure what that was. Did we do that already? I think we may. Okay, we'll see.
I don't think so.
Okay. Alright, we'll see. Okay, so back over here. Back to here, let's see where we are. Okay. Now, I had a question. Questions like this. We talked earlier about, and the verse is, where he's talking about justice in the last area, how you know, some righteous people have the faith of wicked, some wicked people have the faith of the righteous. And he said, if a person wants to search this out, this is in 8:17. I've seen all the works of God, and a person is not able to find them out. All the actions, all the occurrences that happen under the sun. If a person wants to seek him out, he won't find them. And if a person is wise, if he wants to know them, he won't be able to figure them out. Meaning both practically and theoretically, it just escapes in order to come up with a rule, to come up with a principle. Because you just, first of all, you can't find all the cases. It's just innumerable, we said. So in order to have a rule, you have to examine all cases. If one case doesn't, you know, play out according to the rule, then it's not a rule. By definition, a rule means all the time. Like, you can't say that there's this gravity on Earth, and if 1% of the Earth's surface, things don't stay on the ground. Then you can't say there's gravity on Earth. You can say there's gravity, but then you have to modify it. All places except for this location. So in terms of finding out justice and seeing how the world operates, it was just, you can't find it out. But interesting thing here is that from one case alone, where the wise man, the poor wise man who saves the city, So now he makes a rule. I'm just wondering if we could say anything on that. He says in 16, and I said that better is wisdom than strength. Even though the wisdom of the poor person is despised, and his words are not listened to. So you hear my question. The question is, from one case alone, King Solomon seems to be making a rule, whereas earlier it seemed to be difficult to make any type of rule. So I'm just wondering if we can think into that for a moment and to see what the difference might be and why he can do that here. Everybody hear the question?
Yeah, I got it.
Because let's say you have a...
Rabbi,
yeah, go ahead, Doug.
I was going to say, in 8:17, he's talking about a deed done under the sun, so which I presume to be an act of some sort.
Yeah, the fate... He's talking about the fate of the righteous and the fate of the wicked. Yeah, because you see, it's continuing from 8:14. He says there's a futility that's performed on the land, that they're righteous that have the fate of the wicked, and they're wicked that have the fate of the righteous. And I said that this is hell. This is futility. Meaning, when he says I'm saying this futility, it's because he's saying that this type of a statement is futile. Not that life is futile because you don't know what you're going to end up with yourself. He's saying again that the position of people that make this statement, that how come the righteous people have it bad, that type of a state, he said this is futile. And he goes on, and he continues in a few verses, but he seems to be saying on this, remaining on this theme. And I gave my heart over 8:16, to know with wisdom and to see the matter that's done on the land. Even day and night, sleep to my eyes, I did not see. And you see how much he's toiling over this very point. And that's where he goes into 17, and he continues, and he says that you can't find it out. It seems to be he's talking about that very topic. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if these are two different things that are being compared. So if we say in 8, chapter 8, he's talking about, what happens to the wicked versus what happens to the righteous, and then in verse 17, I saw all the deed of God, so it would be presumably the actions that are being attributed to God that apply to the righteous and to the wicked, okay, that a person can't figure it out. But then over in 9, he's talking about wisdom is better than might. Now he seems to be focused on the realm of what's possible for a human being to do.
Good. That's a good distinction. One's talking about God's justice and one's talking about a human being, right? So that's a good step.
Right. So within the realm of sort of attributes or characteristics or skills or whatever that I could have on the planet as a person, he's saying it's better to be wise than to be strong, physically strong.
But the question will come up, so why is that? Why can he take one case and make a rule? I mean, aren't there cases where, let's think about it. Are there cases where, wisdom, you could use your cunning, but, it's not going to save the city? Is that possible?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, so you're saying, why did they conclude this from that particular case?
From one case. I don't care from this particular case, but the question I'm asking is that it seemed to be earlier you couldn't make a conclusion on something. And it's true, there is a difference of topics, and we'll see if that plays a role in the answer. I don't have the answer yet. It just struck me this morning that here he's making a conclusion just from one case.
conclusion is from more than the one case. In other words, it's not, okay, I saw this case in 15, and therefore from that case alone, I concluded 60. But more, I saw a case in 15, and based on everything I knew about wisdom versus strength, I concluded 60. In other words, 15 is kind of a catalyst for the conclusion, but not the sole evidence for it.
Uh-huh. Well, he's pretty descriptive, because when he concludes in 16, he still seems to be remaining true just to the facts of this case. He's not now making, he's not making a broad rule. He should have just said that wisdom is greater than might. But no, he goes back and he says, even though in this case the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words aren't heard. It sounds like he's remaining just within this case. That's my problem with that. Separate thing, the fact that nobody's paying attention to it, that comes back to the social again. And why does he bring it up again? But let's just stay true to the one element of him making a rule on one case. Why is it justified? Whereas prior, it seemed to be that since you didn't have all the facts and all the cases of justice on earth, you couldn't make a rule. Now, it occurs to me that in that case of justice, there were conflicting cases. Here, he just cites one incident. And like you said, also, it's talking about God. So since you can't really exhaust all the instances, the occurrences of how people have, what fate is met by each person, so you can't make a rule. You can't make a rule also just because you find facts that are conflicting. The righteous don't always have it good. You have some cases where they have it, you know, and they're having a tough life. So you can't say the righteous, you know, if you're righteous, everything's going to be perfect for you. You can't say that. But here he's ready to say, and he does say it, that you have one case where wisdom succeeds, therefore it is a rule. It is better than might. And I'm just wondering if it's because if all you need is one case. I mean, if I take a knife and I cut through paper, so I've shown you that the knife has a quality of sharpness to cut through the paper. I don't have to cut every single piece of paper. I've now shown a property. I mean, in terms of how the world operates, so there are definite properties that are unchanging. So once you show an instance, that is the rule, since there's nothing changing. In case of justice and so on, you don't know all the variables. So there is things that are, you could say there is changing. There's other conditions that are coming up in the person's life. So you can't make a statement, just righteousness, because there's many extenuating circumstances and variables that you're not aware of. But here, if you just pit up two things, there is a control set that you have in front of you. They always talk about like a control group and another group when you do statistics and you want to see, you know, what causes, you know, yield what effects. So from one case, you can, and it could be just based on the fact that there are definite properties. Wisdom has a definite property. What's the definite property of wisdom? It understands, whereas might doesn't have the ability to understand. Might is just a brute force. And if you have wisdom, so in the case of might, there's ways to work it out, to understand how to get around. You could maneuver, you could have strategies. You can split the camp into two, like Joshua when they went into I believe it was the city of Ai, and they had one camp, and they had one set of people coming in, and they lured them out, and the whole city came out after them, but they didn't realize that Joshua had another group waiting behind them. And then in a blow of a horn or whatever it was, the two groups of the Jews that now sandwiched the city of Ai in between, they attacked from both sides, confused them, and they succeeded because of wisdom. So there is one expression of where wisdom is going to overcome might. Or the case over here in the city, he doesn't say how the wisdom of this poor man worked, but since wisdom is something which examines and can see all variables, it can come up with a way around might. Because its very nature of wisdom is to relate to all variables and to strategize. Might doesn't have that. Might is not a thinking thing. So based on that, he can make the rule. Because there are definite, supreme properties of wisdom over might. That is an absolute. And that doesn't change. So then you can make a rule. In terms of justice and all, you don't have all the cases, and you don't have all, the variables are constantly in flux, and there's so many different issues. And that's not something which a person has the ability to make the rule about. Does it make sense?
Yes, but
yeah.
Doesn't he then, in your analysis, you've just drawn on other cases. So
no, I'm giving examples myself just to illustrate the point. I'm not using the cases. Go ahead.
Okay, so then what about the case where a mugger sneaks up behind Albert Einstein walking down the street and whacks him over the head, knocks him down, and steals his wallet and runs away?
Well, there you didn't have wisdom at all in the play. Or you could say that...
Could I?
He should have never been alone in a dangerous area, something like that. I can give you two answers right off the bat. Precaution is wisdom. No precautions were taken here, so he got hurt. Or wisdom didn't have a chance to engage in the situation here, so you can't blame wisdom in this case. Something unforeseen, you can't penalize wisdom about that. That's why in the Torah, you have a principle in the Torah that if somebody's coerced in a certain situation, they had him at gunpoint, you know, eat this ham sandwich or else we're going to kill you. You eat it. So coercion, meaning things out of your control, you are exempt. You have no sin whatsoever. There's no blemish for doing that. Same idea.
So I guess what's bothering me here is maybe the initial point that you raised, there's a single case. Okay, and then the case I was bringing up with Albert Einstein is somebody conclude, stealth is better than smarts. You know, Albert Einstein, smartest guy around, but stealth got, you know, won over him. In this case, okay, he said, I know of this case where a poor man extricated the city through his wisdom. Okay, but does that mean in every single case that wisdom would win over might, or aren't there some cases where might win over wisdom? In other words, to your point, I don't disagree with his conclusion, but it seems like to make it on the basis of a single case leaves open the possibility there could be other countercases.
Well, what would you say regarding the point that wisdom has certain properties that are just absent in might.
I agree with that completely.
Okay, and I think that I think also that's what he says in 17 to bring out. That's why the next verse he says that the words of the wise, even are pleasantly spoken, they are heard, as opposed to the cries of a ruler over the fools that he's, a king. What does he mean to say? That you don't need anything but the concepts, even spoken softly, the wisdom is true. It complies with reality. Might does not always comply with reality. Might is just it's like a force that just is just used, without any thinking. By definition, might itself extracted from a person, and that's what he's talking about. This might per se is not something which is, solves problems. It doesn't have the ability to finesse and to, intelligence is not part. It's like, a rock can't think. Might also can't think. Might is just a physical force. So now what do we do with the other cases? Einstein's walking down the street and somebody bops him over the head and steals his wallet. So is that a rejection of this? Or do we say that since wisdom didn't have a chance to enter the scene, you can't really talk about that stealth or might ruled over wisdom in that case. Even though he's a wise person, but it was never engaged. Wisdom was never, when you place the two head on, then you have a fair case.
That's a fair point. Should we consider that stealth itself is a property too of wisdom? I mean, that actually, even though it's being used in a bad manner, there's a reason somebody sneaks up behind Einstein instead of tries to wrestle him to the ground.
I don't understand your question.
Well, I don't think stealth equates to might, is really what I'm saying. I think stealth is a property of wisdom, and the only wisdom being exhibited in the illustration is helping actually prove the point that stealth overcomes, maybe not in this case, might, but that the stealth is a property of wisdom, and therefore wisdom, as it is engaged, does leads to success. The only wisdom engaged leads to success here.
Well, I agree that stealth and might are two different things, but I don't see why you're saying stealth is a property of wisdom. I mean, a brute, could be very, very quick, and he could be very cunning and use stealth. But stealth, I don't see why you're saying it's a property of wisdom. I mean, might, according to you, can also be a property of wisdom. Wisdom can decide that might is the right approach right now, or it could say that stealth. I don't think either ones are properties of wisdom. They're powers. They're strategies that wisdom can harness.
I think I understand Jim's point that in this case, if a wise person might use stealth as a strategy. And so my example doesn't compare might per se with wisdom. It compares stealth, which could be used either by a wise person or a bad person.
Right.
So that makes sense to me. Thanks, Jim.
Jim, you see my point?
I do.
Okay, but I guess in Doug, your case, it's probably better if we use the case of just, brute force. A guy is like a robber. He comes right up to you with a gun, a big, big guy, and very quickly, punches you out. Well, that's not stealth. He's not doing it, covertly. But there, I guess, would be a case of force that wisdom didn't have a chance to engage itself yet. But like Jacob, who was being approached by his brother Asaph and 400 men, so that's a case of might against wisdom. And Jacob worked out a plan where he appealed to his emotions, he gave him gifts, he also planned a strategy politically, and he called him my master. He was very, very complimentary. He knew what emotions to, you know, which buttons to push. Yeah. It was just an interesting question. I mean, I'm sure there's more to be said on this. It just struck me, so I wanted to bring that up. And I'm not saying this is conclusive. At the moment, it seems to me that King Solomon could make this conclusive statement because he's talking about the very properties. And that's why he says in 17, I think that backs it up, that you see from the way wisdom works that you don't have to put any force behind it. The wisdom itself is something which is heard. People reckon that if you just listen to it, a calm, you know, spoken word that's true, it resonates as truth. Nothing more is needed. Meaning the very design complies with how the world operates. And your person can't deny reality. Sakata can. I'm always hesitant to move forward because, you know, you're talking about King Solomon, all this is, you know, divinely inspired wisdom. That's why it became, you know, the part of the works of the Torah. And to move on before you feel that you've really covered everything, I mean, you're never going to cover everything. It's just there's so much more. So, you know, I'm just looking over now these very verses. I mean, you could spend weeks on them. So we did point out last week also that even though the poor wise man saved the city, people don't remember the poor man. I mean, we noted that it leaves out the fact that he was wise there. Because we said that since people, again, it's talking about the social realm, a person does not want to socialize or be associated with a poor person. His own status, he feels, is being marred by the fact that he's standing there talking to a poor person in front of all the friends. So that's why people will not remember this guy who is poor. Not, you see, the wise element is not which bothers them socially. The fact that he's poor. They don't want to be associated with that because that's something which bothers them. So that's just a foolish notion that people carry around. And conversely, people always want to be, you know, you see the person is very wealthy, he's always got a crowd around them. And I think part of that is the very conscious desire that, or unconscious, I'm not sure how often it switches back and forth, but I'm sure plenty of people, they're very friendly with the wealthy, they're looking for a handout. There's this feeling that, oh, you know, I'm really your friends, and maybe I'll get some of it. Because why else are they gravitating around him? What's the only other element that he has, that the only other feature? It's wealth. You don't see a middle-income guy in the synagogue, you know, with crowds around him. And it's interesting too that the wealthy, many times, you know, it just feeds the egomania, and you feel you can, anything you say is gold. So it's a very dangerous thing. It's dangerous for people, and it's dangerous for a person that has it. All right. I'm sure you see many instances in history where wealth led people to want to take positions of power. It wasn't enough that you just had all the wealth. What was missing? There's a little bit more fame that I can have. And they were convinced that they were worthy. And we also, I think we said this last week, tell me if I'm not mistaken, but that why is it that the wise person is poor? Did we answer that?
I don't think we did.
I had a conversation. It's maybe it was with Rivka. I was talking maybe after the class. The point is that because there's a statement of the rabbis that from the poor people comes forth Torah. So the person will typically look at that statement that the poverty is causing wisdom, because that's the way the statement is structured. So they look at it in time. The first thing, the verse, is poverty. From the poor comes forth Torah. So they think that poverty comes first, and then comes Torah, but that's a mistake. It's counterintuitive. It's because the person is involved in wisdom, and that's what they really want. They're not chasing after wealth. So that leads them to a life where there may be poverty. And it doesn't mean it's when the rabbi says something. So when is it a rule? When is it 100% of the time? When it's not, you have to have experience in life to know, or experience in the statements, or what the topic is. But a person who's intelligent, the wise person, he works. He doesn't want to be in a poor state. That's not a good state to be in. And many of the great rabbis were rich, very wealthy. So I'm just saying here that when it says here that the poor man is the one that's wise and he saved the city, I'm just bringing in a complimentary point to the rabbis that from the poor come forth Torah. Why? Because a person who's very immersed in Torah is not chasing after money. So he will quite possibly become poor. So it's not the poverty which causes the Torah, the wisdom. It's the search for wisdom and that attraction and that immersion in the wisdom that precludes him from going after, a 9-to-5, a 9-to-6, a 9-to-8 job, which he could earn millions. He's not doing that because he really wants what's eternal. He wants wisdom. So he has less money than the next person. So that's why it is that a lot of times you'll see that it's the poor person that's the wise person.
Yeah, but wait a second, though. That seems like then it proves both cases, because we'll say, well, if a person is in Torah, then they're not chasing after wealth, so therefore they're poor. And if a person is wealthy, we'll say, well, he studied Torah and he learned ideas of wisdom and consequences and applied them in the business world, and therefore he became wealthy. It doesn't seem like we can have it both ways. Because I thought one of the points of wisdom and learning is that it does teach you how to be successful in the physical world.
Right. It's not. This is not a case of a rule that is 100%. I don't really have the definition why that is, because the very fact, you're right, like we just said, you have wealthy people that are very wise, and you have poor people that are wise. But there is a truth to the point that if a person is involved in one thing, he can't be involved in something else. And the greater involvement, the greater wisdom, right? The greater involvement in the Torah, the greater wisdom, and the less amount of time, all things being equal. So if a person works less, he has less. So I think the statement is solid. And it's not that he's looking for it either. I mean, a lot of times, it just happens. Things just don't work out. You don't have all the variables in front of you. So even though a person may be wise and he tries hard to make a living, sometimes it could be the people he's associating with, the part of the economic area that he's in. Maybe he's got some sins and the providence is not, God's providence is not, he's not worthy of getting it at that time. This is a lot of variables. It goes back to the point that we just said earlier, that in terms of justice, as soon as things work out, there's many, many variables. Not everything is up to the person. Very little is up to the person. What do you say, Doug?
I'm
except I'm accepting what? That there's a principle that the, from the poor comes forth Torah?
Yeah, because...
You mean you want it to be a steadfast rule 100%? Well, tell me exactly what the problem is.
Well, to say from the poor comes forth Torah, based on the way, if I understand you just described the answer, we could also say from the middle class comes forth Torah, because they're involved partly in learning, and they're involved partly in making a living. And then we could say, from the wealthy come forth Torah, because they're involved in Torah learning, and they applied those lessons at a minimum amount of time during the day, and managed to make a fortune. So at the end of the day, what did we actually say?
Right.
We've sort of covered the entire waterfront, and so I don't...
But we are saying something true. We can say the poor are skinny, but you still find middle income and wealthy people that are skinny, right? But it's not a falsehood to isolate the fact that poverty leaves a person with very little food and he loses weight. So that is true. You are going to find, it's not precluding and saying this is the only case, but it is a statement that was verbalized because there is a new point that is being brought out. Sometimes you have a rule that's 100%. I know we have to clarify because I said that half an hour ago that if a rule doesn't apply to all cases, it's not a rule. So therefore we can't make a statement like this to the rabbis that this is a rule. We have to call it something else. That there's a principle. They're highlighting a principle.
And I guess I'm not understanding what's the unique principle that comes out of the statement from the poor comes forth Torah. Because if it's simply saying, well, they're so immersed in Torah that they don't focus on earning a living because they're just so immersed in Torah, I could also say, well, from the unhealthy comes forth Torah. Because they're so interested in learning, they don't pay any attention to getting good nutrition or taking care of themselves or exercising. I mean, I could say that about any group and make that same rationale. That's what's bothering.
Give me a sec. Let me think. Again, the context I don't have in front of me. I'm wondering if when they said it, it was also in the context of that. You know, typically, as we see from here, a poor person is despised. That's what King Solomon's point is. That they don't remember this poor man that saved them. Why does he have to tell us they don't remember him? Because in terms of socially, people don't want to... They despise people that are poor. That it bothers them to be too close to them. What are my friends going to say? So I'm wondering if there's another element here that when the rabbi says from the poor comes forth Torah means don't have the despicable type of a relationship to them. Because this is where Torah comes from. There's something else to the poor person. Not in all cases. But I'm wondering. I'd have to actually go and try to trace down and see if that's part of a larger area, maybe the Talmud, where they talk about this, where it was stated.
Can I offer a possible alternative explanation of that statement?
Yeah, sure.
So, could it mean that you're right, that people normally probably distance themselves from the poor and despise the poor, or at least think, oh, they're a different class of people because, you know, I have some degree of wealth and they would have just worked harder or something like that. And so maybe the verse is saying, when I recognize that they are the same as me, and I use the resources I have to help them, Allah, via charity, that I open up my identification to them, and I see essentially a broader picture of the world, that, yeah, I'm just one person in here, and there are other people, because of whatever circumstances I fell into, I have a certain degree of, you know, monetary resources, And by recognizing, no, it's just good. By recognizing that it's not just because, oh, I worked hard and they didn't, but people end up in different degrees in life, that actually teaches me the wisdom or the idea of Torah, of justice, if you will. And so, from the poor person, that is my paying attention to them and identifying with them and, you know, including them as part of my life experience, and helping to care for them, that in itself is Torah growth for me.
But that's talking about you. The statement is that from the poor comes forth Torah, that they are filling the world with Torah themselves. So I don't think that complies with the plain reading of the statement.
Isn't it that prioritization, so that even though there are rich who further Torah, they still aren't seeking riches. They still have the same mindset as that poor person who is putting forth Torah. So Torah doesn't come from the rich in the same way it comes from the poor, because those rich are more incidentally rich than they are because they strove for riches. If they were striving for riches, they wouldn't have been striving for Torah learning. They were able to attain riches, nonetheless, but yeah, it's not their main focus.
Yeah, the rabbis say that too. Says that, wisdom does not come from people that are too invested in wealth. Lo hamarva b'schora makhim, which means it will not happen that if a person is putting the majority of his energies into work, it will not happen that he will become wise. Because he's merely involved in the world of manipulating the stock or this product he's making or marketing, whatever it is, it's more involved. He's just manipulating, and that's using the world's resources, using strategy, politics, connections, whatever, to make a buck. So he's making the buck. He's involved in wealth, but the time that he's doing that, he's not involved in thought, which requires great amount of patience and sharpness of the mind. And as a person continues in his learning, it sharpens the mind more and more and more. The more a person is just involved in manipulating resources and so on, he's further and further away from any type of thought. So he doesn't have the apparatus of the mind to uncover new marvels. So you're right. But again, I think the point is that it's true, you're going to find people that are middle-income and wealthy that have the way, but what the rabbis are doing are isolating the fact that the person who really engages in wisdom, it is going to be a proportional amount less involved in work. And the greatest intelligence is going to, at times, really come from the people that they're so attracted to it. And they're really putting very little time. The fact is, who said that they're bothered by their poverty? Some of these people, it doesn't bother them because they are so enlightened by what they're seeing, they're happy to have just, you know, a few meals a day, or one meal a day, whatever it is. They don't have to have such a big wardrobe. They don't have to have a big, big, fancy place. They got a simple car and so on. So They're poor compared to everybody else. The truth you have to think about also is that who said that they're unhappy? The truth is also that the rabbis say, and I was just reading in Ethics of the Fathers, we talked about it in, you know, Maimonides, Shmita, and Yovel. But I think it's chapter 3 in Ethics of the Fathers, it also talks about that. The person who is very much engaged in wisdom, so then he won't have the yoke of the government and the yoke of business considerations on his neck. And I'll read it to you. Let me get it. Hold on. It's a providential statement. You know, the same exact thing that Maimonides says, and maybe that's where he gets it from. I'm not sure. Yeah, this is in my edition here, chapter 3, and it's Mishnah 5. So Reb Nechunya, the son of Hakna, he said, anybody who accepts upon himself the yoke of Torah, there's removed from him the yoke of government and the yoke of a business, meaning it's made easier for him. But anybody who breaks off from his neck, he breaks off the yoke of Torah. I mean, he doesn't take Torah seriously. So then there's placed upon him the yoke of government and the yoke of earning a livelihood. Okay. So what does my mind say on this? He says, the diligence in reading. So he says, a person takes upon himself the yoke of Torah, because calling the Torah a yoke seems to be a problem, because our position is that it's a very enjoyable thing. Wisdom is fantastic. Nothing compares to it. Really, King Solomon said, it's like, you know, the wise are like, you know, wisdom is like light. So how can you call it the yoke? So that's what Maimonides comes to. He says the diligence in reading, meaning maybe it's reading and covering ground, something which is just the foundation work that's necessary until you have enough, you're well-versed in all the writings and all the Talmud. I mean, that's tremendous, that is diligent, that is a lot of toil. That's what they call it, toiling in Torah. But in order to really be wise, you have to have all the sources in front of you, on your fingertips, and you can't have the sources without real diligence. So perhaps that's why my mind is calling the yoke of Torah, meaning he's saying specifically, it's not the sitting back and luxuriating over the beautiful ideas like we're doing now. He's saying that no, there's a certain aspect that really does require diligence and plowing through a lot of ground and you know, being that strength. Okay, he says further, so then the person does this. So then having to work in the government or be in the king's armies, this will be removed from him. And he also says the yoke of business, so he calls it the bother of the time, meaning things that he has to do on a daily basis. And he says further that the reward of taking upon himself the yoke of Torah, God, blessed be He, will save him, and He'll make it very light for him to take care of his needs. Okay, that's Maimonides. And let me see if Rabbeinu Yonah has something on this. I believe he does. So he says, because you know the ethics also says he's supposed to make your learning the essence of your day, and the work should be the smaller part. So Rabbeinu Yonah comments on this mission, and he says, after a person makes his Torah the essence of his day, and he treats his business just like a light part of the day, so God will watch over him from any evil thing, and he won't have to remove himself from his studies. V'loitein b'leiv. And it sounds, I read it last night, a little difficult, but I think what he means is that, and there will not be placed in his heart this tyrant that takes away a person's soul, that he should do his work. Meaning like the tyrant, the thing that pushes a person, accomplishment and success. It sounds like he's saying that that's going to be removed from him. And he'll be saved. It sounds like he's saying it providentially. He'll be saved from the work of those that type of tyranny in order to fulfill the will, his will, to be involved in Torah. And he says further that if he does involve himself in Torah and he's really diligent with this, he will not need to do much work for his need. and he'll be satisfied with a little. See, that now sounds like we're talking about what is the definition of a poor person. So it just means poor in terms of how much money, but not in terms of his, the fact that he's satisfied. He's very satisfied. All right. Okay. All right, so it's just later. So let me just, I guess we'll stop here. Let me see if there's any other questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I heard what you said about if you take on the yoke of the Torah, then you won't have to worry about the yoke of government or business or whatever. So there are people who take on the yoke of religion and Torah and try to learn and still are struggling with sustenance. So how do we talk to people like that? What do we tell them, just to continue what they're doing?
Yeah, again, all things being equal, but let's say a person is doing something wrong in life, so God can penalize him in terms of money. He can also be foolish about where he's spending money. A person has to be intelligent in all the areas. So we don't, again, that goes back to the fact that King Solomon said earlier that we can't, you know, if we search out all the cases, we will not be able to get to an answer in that case because there's just too many variables.
Okay. Okay, that's good. Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, King David said it, that the person who's righteous and he's not with any sin. So, you know, numerous bad things can approach him, but he will be saved from all of them. So we have to keep in mind these statements that, again, they're divinely inspired, so they have to be absolutely true. Now, if a person is having something negative, so then, again, there's variables. We just don't know the entire case.
Okay, that explains it. Okay.
Yeah, but you have to keep in mind that God is fully knowledgeable of everything, and if a person is not deserving, it would be unjust for God to allow something negative to happen to him. Let's say he's using all his cunning, he's trying to be intelligent as possible, and he is not, spendthrift, and so in those cases, these people are not going to have a difficulty. We shouldn't look at them and see if they're poor and say, oh, yeah, they must be miserable. That's also not an accurate thing to do, because who said that that's something that they're really valuing? You give a person who's miserable and he lives in a palace, and a person who lives in a shoebox, and he's thrilled. Every day he enjoys his studies. He has a friend or two. I mean, the barometer, you know, has to be adjusted to reality, not to, you know, the a focus that might be skewed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, so I guess we'll, any other questions?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Okay. At this point.
All right. All right, Doug, thanks for battling it out with me.
You're welcome, Rabbi. Thank you.
Yeah, if there's any other thoughts on this, like I said, I'm not giving a conclusive seal, you know, personally on, you know, the main point that I brought up about why he was able to make a rule in this case about wisdom, where he didn't make a rule about justice, but I think there's truth in it. I think the verse, you know, 9:17 might bear that out, but we'll think it over, and if there's anything, you know, you have in mind or anybody else, you know, feel free to share it with me, right?
Okay.
All right, everybody. So have a good week. We'll pick up next week.
Okay. Thanks, Rabbi. You too.
Okay, thanks.
Rabbi.